So I believe we're ready to begin. Welcome to our High Notes this week. As always, we're using High Notes as a way to introduce important musical activity that we will be presenting later in this week. Another aspect of High Notes when it's live in Aspen is that it's a very informal chance for our audience to get to know our artists. And thus, we look for some personal insights and also musical insights, not to put too much burden on our participants today. But we have a great lineup today, and we're going to start with Tim Adams. So, Tim, if you want to unmute, there you are. Hello.
Hello. Hey.
So, Tim and I met 20 years ago when he was the principal as timpanist in the Pittsburgh Symphony, and he was a member of the faculty at Carnegie Mellon University, where I also worked, and he had one of the most amazing studio classes I have ever known in my whole career, and that's saying a lot, amazing in a very positive sense, and you might get to that in a minute, Tim.
It meant a lot to me as a human. The music part, of course, was great, but I really miss the humanity of being around them. And that's kind of the nutshell of my career so far.
That is cool. And so I will say, in those Pittsburgh days, the thing about your studio is you were the coolest guy, but you gave that to everybody. That is, all of your students were the coolest students, and they had the best of them. And you gave them so much faith in themselves that it's just, you know, if you really work hard and you can get somewhere. And you're also very eloquent about your parents. I don't think they were musicians, but they really supported you.
Well, actually, yes, my father was a band director.
Okay.
My father was a band director and my mother was a principal. And, you know, they really instill the value of being a responsible human being and being very knowledgeable and asking questions about life and music. And in that way, it gave me the tools to navigate the world. It really did. And so it was, and to speak to just briefly about my students, I mean, I was committed to them and I was committed to each one individually. So I didn't have a curriculum that was cookie cutter. It was strictly to the person that I was teaching. So each person felt like I was invested in them because that's how I was taught. I mean, my teachers, all of my teachers knew me. They took the time to, if they asked, how are you today, Tim? They really meant it. And if I spoke to them about anything, they listened and they responded to what I was saying. And I saw the value of being present. And by being present, you know, the students has an opportunity to find themselves in music. And I was committed to that. Oh. And so, you know, I'm a musician. So the best way that we do what we do is to express ourselves. And we've always been the conscience of the world since biblical times. I mean, the artists have been telling the story of what's going on. So it's my turn.
Well, it's a fantastic project, and we're proud that we'll be part of the New York University percussion ensemble piece, and we'll also be part of an Atlanta symphony piece.
Oh, thank you.
So we do have a question from our audience, which has to do about blind auditions. I'm sure you saw Ray Tomasini's article last week.
Yeah, I did.
And, you know, what's, as an orchestra professional through much of your life, what's your thought about that?
Yeah, you know, I remember reading the article, and all my years, I've probably taken 28 auditions. I've always wanted the screen to come down. I want people to see me. I never felt like I would not get a job because of the color of my skin, because I'll just be better. I was ready to play, you know, so I mean, I was trained, I'm prepared. They certainly won't give a black person a principal position just for diversity, because you could train wreck a band. So no one gave me four jobs. So, you know, blind auditions help, but it's the systemic racism of our country that needs to be addressed. So, you know, it's a supply issue. There are very few people of color in music schools. So, you know, you need more of a supply. And you get that supply by taking arts organizations to communities of color and just play and then leave. It's a very, very, very simple concept that I spoke to about many times in my orchestras and no one really listened. It's like a very, but it has to be a 50 or 60 year commitment. None of us will be here for the end, but it's a very simple commitment and it will change and it can change. It's really about exposure. So, you know, just that's my answer. I mean, I could go on and on and on, but does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Thank you. So, Tim, thank you. And you are teaching a really wonderful seminar with our percussion class that would have been with us in 2020 in Aspen, but it's a virtual class. And now my notes have failed me.
Well, actually, I did it. I did a class already. Are we talking about the same one or something?
I think it hasn't been broadcast yet.
I knew that. Oh, you want me to tell you about it? Tell about the class?
No, just I wanted to let the audience know.
Yes, okay.
When to hear it. I think it is Wednesday.
Okay.
No, yeah. It is Thursday at 5 p.m. Mountain Time, so 7 p.m. Eastern Time, Thursday on AspenMusicFestival.com, or you can get to it through our Facebook page as well. And it's a fabulous class. It's Tim Adams with students in Aspen. So thank you.
Thank you so much. So good to see you.
Great. Good to see you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
So we're going to turn now to Veda Kaplinsky. Veda is chair of the piano department at the Juilliard School. She's also dean of the pre-college division at the Juilliard School, and she has also long been a leader in our piano department in Aspen. So it is a great pleasure to see you, Veda. How are you?
To be here. The next best thing to being in Aspen.
Yes, well, and so Veda is leading also this week a showcase of three absolutely brilliant young pianists, all of whom would have been with us this summer in Aspen, and they have produced essentially a concert that Veda curates and introduces. And so I thought you might tell us a little about those three students.
We chose three pianists ranging in age from 10 to 16 because I think that it's always fun for Aspen concert goers to listen to these young kids and then years back say, oh, I knew them way back when. The way people now speak about Elisa and other great musicians who have come to Aspen as children and really wowed the audiences with their abilities. So the first one is 10-year-old Shenran Shi. I believe that this would have been her first summer in Aspen. And our second pianist is Joshua Moon. And the program will end with Harmony Zhu. Each one of them is a very interesting character in their own right, but it's interesting to note that they do have in common the fact that they're Aspen students and the fact that they're also the fellows in the Lang Lang International Music Foundation, and or scholars, I believe they call them. They share a huge love of music and a really true commitment, each in their own way, polished in her playing way, way past her years. And Harmony is a person that's very well known to the Aspen family. She's been there every year since she was 8. She's now 14. Her performance is astounding, not just because she is a wonderful pianist, but because she's playing a piece that most professional pianists find almost impossible to play. And she plays it on such a high level with so much maturity, color, understanding of the music that it's really quite fascinating to hear. Well, thank you. The greatest compliment you can you can give me as a teacher is that all the students sound like themselves and not like me or like each other. And that's frankly one of my greatest aspirations, is to find the personality that's there and develop that. And with Harmony, it was easy because she's pretty much, she was born a musician. And I don't know the other two as well, but I am sure that just like they have their own personalities now, they will develop that way and find artistic expression in their own ways. Just as an aside, to Harmony's credit, you know, some of these kids really think, I mean, they know how good they are, and when they're very successful, they feel like they're sitting on top of the world. I had to really talk Harmony into playing this piece. She really resisted and resisted because she felt she wasn't worthy of it. Wow. And I had to finally convince her, and it was only, I think, after she played the piece for another person on our faculty, Fabio Bedini, who is teaching somewhat online this summer. And his word for it was fantastic. And she came to me, she says, well, maybe I can do it. So she did, and it's quite something to hear. I think when she grows up and she listens to this recording, she's going to be very proud of it.
Fantastic. Well, so this piano showcase, which I ask the audience to believe me, is just stupendous, will be on Wednesday of this week. I think also at,
it's 5 o'clock also.
5 o'clock Mountain Time. So I think that's 7 o'clock Eastern Time on Wednesday. And I think these showcases are staying up on our site for about a week, something like that. So if you can't make the Wednesday time, still come to our website and look for it. You will be grateful to Veda for having chosen these wonderful students and presenting them. So thank you. Okay. We turn now to cellist Alyssa Weilerstein and pianist Enon Barnaton, who are together in La Jolla, California. And there they are. Hello.
Hello. Hi.
So Alyssa and Enon are our featured artists next Sunday at our 3 p.m. Mountain Time, 5 p.m. Eastern Time Sunday concert. And they will be playing two Beethoven cello sonatas. But I thought we would start with just some personal details. How is it that you are together in the room? What's going on? What's happening?
You want to start?
I run a music festival here in La Jolla, in California. We're actually in kind of the grounds of the Conrad, which is the concert hall that we opened last year. Last week, actually, I got here a week ago. I drove from New York City to San Diego over a week. I almost stopped in Aspen, but there wasn't enough time, I'm afraid. But I drove over here about a week ago, and then as soon as I got here, took a COVID test, and as soon as I got the negative result, went straight to her house, and we decided we're going to be a pod together because we're playing together both for you guys and also later on for La Jolla Festival, Summerfest. So.
Okay. And Alyssa, you're there because your husband, Rafael Payare, is the music director at San Diego Symphony. And
correct.
So you are all living there?
We're splitting between Berlin and San Diego, but we've basically been, during the pandemic, we've been living here.
Okay.
So we've been based here since March 13th, pretty much. I took a trip to Germany in early June and quarantined for 2 weeks in my apartment in Berlin, and then played live broadcast with at the Elbphilharmonie in Hamburg, and then flew back to San Diego. So it was one of those really crazy, traveling through airport dead zones, basically. It was very strange, but you know, I was happy to be able to at least play something.
Yeah. And Elon, is your dog with you?
It is. He is. Yeah. Actually, we were supposed to drive anyway. That was nothing to do with the pandemic. We drive from New York to San Diego because we can't fly with the dog. So.
Yeah.
But we love it. It's the America that you see on the road is this to all of. Yeah. Kind of all of America. It was kind of very, very moving experience.
And actually. I think you're the first friends that were in our house in 4 months as well. So it's wild. It's just really, you know, because we're used to using, I mean, as all of you are, as all of us were talking, I mean, we're all used to running to and fro and traveling. It's like, it's nothing. And now it's a really big deal to do it now. Yeah. So it's, you know, it's a complete shift in mentality.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about Beethoven, because if our summer had gone the way we wished, you would have given all of the Beethoven cello sonatas together. And my first question is, how often have you played that cycle together? And do you go through cycles of the cycle, or do you always make things fresh, or do you rethink in, you know, periodically? How does that work?
It's actually, we haven't done it that often. We've only started.
We did the complete this past season was the first time that we did the complete cycle, and we were actually, we did several in the fall, like we did. So like our very first one was like in October or something like that, and we did a few more, and then we were supposed to do a bunch this spring, and of course that didn't happen for obvious reasons, but we've played. Sometimes we've done two on a program, sometimes we've done one on a more mixed program, that kind of thing. So, we've played all of them various times, many times, but as a complete cycle, we haven't done it that much, actually.
Yeah, context matters. So mm-hmm. when you do the fifth sonata next to Stravinsky, it feels very different than when you're doing it as a cycle. Yeah. So, and going through the cycle and going... and when we play it as a cycle, we play it in order. Mm-hmm. And because there are such extremes, you get two very early opus sonatas, one middle sonata, and then two late sonatas.
Yeah, so you get like three snapshots in a way. Yeah,
you get this kind of journey through Beethoven himself in some ways, and that informs also the way that you play them. It's very difficult to play. Yeah. Them the same, you know, you don't play the fifth sonata or the third sonata the same when you play them in somehow as part of a cycle.
I will be leading a seminar with two of the world's greatest Beethoven scholars, just looking at the legacy, the continuing importance, relevance of Beethoven. And so I've been thinking about this myself a bit. And so, yes, even though, you know, Opus 2, number 1 is... No, I'm saying the wrong opus.
Opus 5, number 1.
Yeah, thank you.
number 1 is a piano sonata. Yes. Really.
Right. But there was essentially no tradition of cello sonatas.
Yeah.
And so there were, of course, violin sonatas, and there were piano sonatas, and there were trios, although the existing trios, mostly the cello parts, were not that great.
They're terrible.
And Beethoven really made a project of this. And then, as you have said already, you know, conventionally he has three periods. I like my friend Lewis Lockwood, who will be part of our thing in the summer, who says first maturity, second maturity, third maturity, because there are fantastic, wonderful things in each segment. But it is striking that Beethoven put important piano and cello works into each of those. Mm-hmm. So to me, and I'm also echoing Lewis Lockwood here, but Opus 69 becomes essentially the model of what a piano and cello sonata is going to be. Mm-hmm. And everybody later is thinking about that. Opus 102 is a little hard to follow, but 69 is the one that people say, oh my gosh, yes. That is so great.
That's the most universally beloved.
Yeah. And along those lines, he was solving really important musical issues about reciprocity between the two players and letting both shine, which, you know, maybe in the early ones he didn't do as well because he would have been playing them himself and he needed to shine. How do you feel each about your performance in terms of that balance?
Well, I mean, this, as you say, it's a really fascinating journey, not only in Beethoven himself, but in the evolution of what a duo sonata is. And to a certain extent, it came from a tradition where the older tradition, the home tradition, in which usually the woman in the house would learn to play piano incredibly well, and then the men would learn violin and cello as much as they did fencing or anything else. And it was the whole tradition of chamber music from the home evolved from the fact that the pianist had skill that the string players didn't have. And then Beethoven himself he suddenly started hearing these incredible virtuosos, these individuals, as Mozart did before him, suddenly heard these people that transcended what he thought was possible with the instrument. And then as soon as he knew what was possible, as Beethoven always does, he pushed it even further. Mm-hmm. But you can hear the entire tradition of string playing come to its own.
Yeah, because we had James Ennison and Andrew Armstrong on 2 weeks ago, and they were doing a Opus 12 sonata, which is published as Sonata for Piano with Violin Accompaniment.
Yes.
They all are, I mean, I think the cello sonatas are also published as
piano and cello. Yes.
Piano and cello,
I
the same
so.
With Brahms. Yeah, but,
I think so. Yeah.
But, you know, there's nothing... I mean,
from the third sonata on, they're equal partners.
And you know, you can kind of feel it the same with the fourth concerto. When the third cello sonata, suddenly the cello starts without the piano. Suddenly, and that is such a psychological shift where suddenly the cello becomes kind of comes to its own in some way.
Yeah, and then the fourth sonata also the cello starts.
Yeah, yeah. So suddenly starting to think of it not as a kind of piano and cello sonata, but really
as equals,
and the cello is being kind of having abilities and having kind of the range that nobody's asked from it before.
For sure, and the third sonata is also the first chance that the cello really has to actually sing. I mean, it's really in the second sonata, of course, it's already shifted a little bit. The balance has shifted a little bit from the first sonata, which is quite extreme in terms of the cello really being a very, very secondary, maybe tertiary role in a way. But the cello really kind of serves as a kind of rhythmic drive in the second sonata, whereas in the third it's a very singing, kind of almost operatic type of language by comparison.
You know, I'm sure you know this, but in the research I've been doing, for Opus 69, the sketches... He lays out all the musical ideas and then refines which person is going to do which thing and consistently chooses to give the cello very long lines.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. No, and one feels it. I mean, and this was, and I think that this also kind of was the precursor for the convention at the time that the cello was actually a really vocal instrument.
And the transition from quote-unquote chamber music to kind of growing beyond the intimate and into
the solo.
Even from the very first sonatas, but this thing, thinking about them as public pieces as much as private pieces.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, you are leading the Summerfest in La Jolla, and Alyssa is going to be an integral part.
James Ennis, by the way.
Tell us about
the small world.
Your plans there.
Well, so we're still hoping, but it seems less and less likely that we'll have a socially distant audience. We're still hoping that we'll be able to have some sort of audience in the hall or outside. But whatever happens, we will have 6 concerts streamed live from the concert hall here, which is a remarkable concert hall. And it's just opened last year. The acoustic was, Toyota did the acoustic, and it's just really, we're so lucky to have this hall that we own, that the society owns. So we're going to have 6 concerts between August 21st and 29th. Each of them 1 hour or less. And there's a group of 7 musicians that are coming here, partly from LA and partly, like me, further afield. But we're becoming a pod, as it were. And we're all playing all 6 concerts just between us. And it's thrilling, actually, to come back to playing live music with other people.
You know, I had we did some live elements in Harris Hall for our tribute to Robert Spano a few weeks ago.
Nice.
And the artists who came live were just in tears because they had not been on a stage, working together. And then James Ennis has also created a similar model as yours for Seattle Chamber Music Society, that they've made a pod. They have lots of testing, lots of care, but yeah, they're able to really work together.
Yeah.
Yeah. And sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying I had the same sensation when I went to Hamburg. That I mean, of course, we know that, I mean, in Germany, they're a bit ahead of us where, with socially distant orchestras. And so they were already past that kind of eureka moment of what it felt like to be on stage. But I had to really work hard to keep it together. I played Rococo variations, and I was just, just trying not to start bawling, basically, because it was such a powerful experience to be on a stage.
So speaking of Europe, what is happening with your Trondheim group?
Well, they're able to rehearse. We very sadly had to, we can't do our tour even next year. In the United States, we were going to do a really big tour, which of course everyone had worked extremely hard on for April 2021. But this is just another example of the ripple effect that this is having, that they couldn't take the financial risk after losing so much to come over. And so hopefully we'll do it at another point. But we do have, we're doing a German tour in March of 2021. So that's so that's good. And that's very much in place, and I believe it will happen. So, but of course, I mean, they're amazing people, amazing musicians, and I love them very much. So I'm looking forward to being back with them.
Huh. And what is San Diego Symphony doing?
They, one of the advantages of this, one of the many advantages of this incredible location and climate is that the weather is great year round. And so there are many contingency plan A's, plans B, plan C, plans D, and a lot of them involve outdoor, contingency plans for outdoor concerts. And so there are lots of possibilities there. And I know they're being worked on. So,
in fact, we're supposed to play in October. We're
playing
triple concerto here in San Diego.
Yeah, which we were supposed to do in Aspen, of course.
We were supposed to do in Aspen. Yeah. And we're hoping that still happens. So.
And I think that there's goodwill and determination here, and I remain cautiously optimistic about that.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, it is wonderful to see you, if only in this way.
Thank you, Alan.
But just much love to both of you and your families. And we are looking forward to Sunday, two Beethoven sonatas for cello and piano. And that is at 3 p.m. Mountain Time on Sunday. We broadcast Tuesday as well. So check out our website, and we'll be together in that way.
Fantastic. Yeah, thank
you. Looking forward.
Yeah.
Okay.